It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, as oil prices fall, so does the profit margin for fracking. We take a look at how the frac sand mining industry is doing in Wisconsin.
First, two state lawmakers are looking to introduce a bill that would make first offense drunk driving a criminal offense in Wisconsin.
We're the only state where a first-time OWI is not a criminal offense. There have been previous attempts to change this, along with other efforts to pass new legislation to tackle the state's drunk driving problem, which have by and large failed in the legislature. So could this one be different?
Joining us now is Therese Brousseau. She's a Democratic state representative from Madison. Representative Brousseau, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for letting me be on your show. I appreciate it.
So make the case, please. Why should Wisconsin criminalize first-time OWI offenses?
Because people die because of drunk drivers. We have, as you know, a terrible record when it comes to drunk driving. And as we saw just this last weekend, we had a 20-year-old drunk driver cause an accident that killed innocent people who stopped to help her. It's really an issue of getting serious and saying you never, ever get behind the wheel when you've had too much to drink.
So getting to the basics, currently, absent your bill, what happens when someone in the state receives that first OWI offense?
Well, right now it's just a civil violation and it's a fine. This would put something on your record. This would say it's a criminal offense, it's a misdemeanor. So it's not, you know, it's not as strong as in some other countries where they take your car away, but it's serious enough that this is something then that's on your record. And the penalties, as far as I'm concerned, still would be awfully light. It would be up to 30 days of confinement and up to $500 fine. But I'm hoping that it is a deterrent to know that this is something that will be on your record, that we take it seriously enough that this is going to follow you.
Now, this isn't the first effort to do something like this. Other attempts to pass drunken driving legislation in the state in recent years, in many cases, have failed. Do you have hopes that this one could go through where others have not?
Well, yes, I do. And I must say that it's bipartisan in support and bipartisan in opposition. So, but we do have a different mix this year. But I do have hope. I know that in the past, one of the issues has been, well, this is a mistake. Somebody's made a mistake. But thinking of mistake in a sort of an innocent term, the statistics show that 65% of drivers who are in a drunk driving crash, it is their first OWI. And then nationally, studies have shown that if people are arrested, they have probably been drinking and driving 80 times before it finally happens that they get caught. Maybe a reflection on how deep into alcoholism they are, I don't know. But anyway, we are the most lenient, or depending on the methodology of the study, the tied with Maryland for being the most lenient in the United States on the issue of first-time drunk driving. So I'm hoping. I mean, we've tried, we've worked at it in the past. I'm hoping this is the magic time.
You mentioned bipartisan support. Your Republican colleague Andre Jacques has signed on as a co-sponsor. How important is it to you that this have bipartisan support?
Well, obviously, with the Republicans in the majority, I need that. Yes, I do have one Republican sponsor, but I do want to mention that Representative Jim Ott, a Republican, has worked on this for many years, and he's working with me as well on this issue, on this bill. I just put it out yesterday, so sponsorships are, you know, it will be a while before I know the full extent of sponsorship and whether people are Republican or Democrat.
Talking to State Representative Therese Brousseau about her efforts to criminalize first-time OWI offenses in Wisconsin. Now, objections to past efforts like this, Representative Brousseau, a couple of objections. One, people say this isn't really a deterrent. None of the laws deter people. We need to address the wider problems of alcohol culture in Wisconsin. This alone won't be that effective. How would you answer that?
Well, you know, sure, this alone isn't going to solve it totally, but there's always a percentage of people who do pay attention to the laws. Look at what happened with the seatbelt law. People like my father, who would never, ever wear a seatbelt, once it was a law, then that mattered to him. Now, what we're hoping more is that there will be the deterrent effect of, you know, this is serious, it's on my record. And there will be more publicity around this should we get this passed. So we're hoping that, I'm hoping, that it's not just that there's a, you know, there's a certain percentage who will say, you know, this is the law, I'm going to follow it. Whether or not people who are drunk are going to think that, of course, is the issue. But to say we should do nothing while we address the larger cultural issues, I would say we are missing the boat in terms of sending a very important message that we consider it serious enough that it's going to be a crime and it's going to be on your record. There's a lot of things we need to do. I don't see those things happening either. So, you know, Wisconsin lags in terms of addressing this problem.
Critics have also pointed toward costs, more people in the court system, tying up courts. Mm-hmm. Are you worried about the fiscal impact of bringing more people into the courts and backlogs in the courts over this?
Well, first of all, I would say that what we have to start thinking about is how much is somebody's life worth. When you talk to the families that go around this building, that come to the Capitol and lobby after they've lost a son or daughter or husband or wife, and you look them in the eye and say, geez, this is our culture or whatever, I mean, is this really, you know, collateral that we feel good about? I think we need to determine what our values are here in Wisconsin in terms of what we are willing to accept in the way of drunk driving deaths. I hope it's zero. Now, yes, one of the other factors is that right now I don't think this legislature is inclined to consider any costs, and most other states, from what I understand, who have criminalized first offense, and that's all of them, have programs for first offenders. We have some in our state, but by no means do we have programs in every county. And ideally, that's what we need. And so, but we've got to start. We have to start and quit making excuses.
You're looking for co-sponsors right now.
Yes.
Beyond that, what do you see as a timeline for this legislation?
Well, I really don't know. As you know, we're still waiting for an agreement on the budget. I just listened to your news. and that hasn't happened yet. And until that is resolved, there probably won't be a lot of other movement on too many issues. I have talked again to, as I said, Representative Jim Ott. This would probably go to his committee. He is, you know, very much interested in this bill and has worked on this issue in the past. So, but whether or not it's going to move yet this spring and early summer, my prediction is fall. That if we get it moving, and if we have good luck this time, it will be sometime in fall.
And do you see any other drunken driving legislation on the horizon from you or your colleagues?
Another state representative, Eric Gingrich, has a bill out related to repeat offenders. And I know that that's something that the public is always aghast at when they say, how can this person be out for the, you know, charged for the ninth time or the seventh time or whatever. We do have very convoluted drunk driving laws. Anyway, so I know he's trying to address that issue, but I don't have the particulars of his bill in front of me right now.
Representative Brousseau, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
That was Democratic State Representative Therese Brousseau. She's planning to introduce legislation that would criminalize first-time OWI offenses in Wisconsin.
As oil prices have fallen, so has the profit margin of hydrofracturing to extract natural gas. While there is no fracking per se in Wisconsin, the state is the top producer of silica sand, which is used in the fracking process.
Last month, U.S. Silica Mining Company told the state that it plans to lay off 30 workers from its Sparta location in July. Sand mining has both injected new income into rural areas and raised health and environmental concerns. Most recently, critics say these layoffs could be foreshadowing what happens when rural towns rely on money for mining operations that won't be there forever.
And we'd like to hear from you on this. Have you seen positive economic impact from sand mining in your community? Do you have other concerns about the industry? You can call us now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Here with us now to talk about how the drop in oil prices is playing out for the industry is Pamela King. She's a reporter at Energy Wire. Pamela, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. How are you doing today?
Good, thank you. Well, you checked into some of the communities where frac sand mining has been an economic player in the town. What kind of effect has revenue from the frac sand industry had in some of these towns you visited?
Well, one town that I visited was the township of Greenfield, and a mine operating there has a development agreement with the town to give 15 cents on the first million tons of sand it ships out and 10 cents on the ton after that. In 2014, that generated more than $200,000 $200,000 payment that has paid for a salt shed. They've paid for a new dump and recycling center for the town. They've developed a little community garden. I also visited Chippewa Falls, and there are just a bunch of downtown revitalization projects happening, new businesses coming in. It really varies from town to town, but some really interesting projects happening there.
So is it fair to say that revenue from frac sand mining has had a demonstrable impact on the economy of these towns?
I think it would be fair to say. It's not always easy to see the impact directly, and that's where some of the criticism comes in. In Chippewa Falls, for example, the mining industry contributed about 2% to the gross regional product. I think that was for Chippewa County overall. So it's a small part. It's a small economic contributor. And it's not a huge employer compared to other industries in the county. But it does offer some of the highest salaries. The average earnings for a worker in that industry, and I think, again, this was for 2014, was $91,000. And those salary benefits, too, can really ripple through a community.
And you look at the past year or so, we've seen a drop in oil prices. What effect has that had on the frac sand mining industry here in Wisconsin?
Things are definitely slowing down. I visited a Superior Silica Sands operation. And that particular site was running maintenance during the day, whereas when things are really going, their operation is running 24/7. But reducing the schedule like that has really helped companies avoid layoffs. We're hearing some news of layoffs. As you mentioned earlier, U.S. Silica announced that layoff of 30 workers in July. A trucking firm in Chippewa Falls has laid off 55 of its employees. But aside from that, we haven't seen too much news. It mostly seems to be that companies are changing the way they operate so they can avoid those kinds of reductions.
Is there any concern among towns in northern Wisconsin that a slowdown could eventually negatively impact the economy?
I think there is, especially among residents who live out in the rural parts of the towns where this activity is actually happening. They're concerned about what are the long-term impacts on the land that is being used for the mines. But it's not going to have the type of effect that we see in some of the communities affected by hydraulic fracturing. Some of those communities are very singularly focused on that activity. And as I said before, the mining industry in this part of the country, it's just a small part of the economy. So there's not going to be any major bust, or that's what it looks like right now.
We're going to take a caller now. We've got Susie joining us from Greenfield. Susie, hi.
Hi. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. And hi, Pam.
Hi, Susie.
Hi. Thank you for everything that you said about the town of Greenfield. We're close to Toma for people here in Wisconsin. You know, it's not just the money that we're getting for the sand that's being shipped out by our local sand mine, but they employed over 60 people in our area, and they're from our area. You know, they have a philosophy of working within a 100-mile radius as much as they can, our sand mine. So, you know, it's nice to see 60 people being employed at a good job and a safe job. So that's been important to us, too.
Susie, have there been any concerns about the viability long-term of frac sand mining operations?
There has been, and our sand mine on a monthly basis attends our township meetings, and just at our last meeting a couple of weeks ago, the question came up as to the longevity of the sand mine. And the sand mine that is in our township is, they think, I know that's a strange thing to say, but their shipping points in their contracts, I mean, where they ship the sand and the location of the fracking industry that uses their sand, you know, their shipping location is in a very good position to the fracking areas, so they assured us that they're going to be okay, and we believe that they will be okay. I guess another thing too, when we're talking about personalities, are that the sand mine hired locally. They're very, very good people. The people who work at our sand mine live in our community, and they join in the activities and groups in our community. So it's very, very nice. I'm not concerned. You know, they're right on a railroad track. Their shipping is in a good area. I'm not concerned that they...
All right. Thank you, Susie. Got the gist of your comment there. And Susie, you heard it there. She's not concerned that she feels the longevity questions have been addressed, that mine owners are confident looking into the future. Is that the general tenor of what you're hearing from people?
Yes. The mine near Susie is very well positioned for the future, as she mentioned. It's right on a rail facility. It has a lot of its operations on site, and they seem to be moving forward very conservatively. And that's been sort of the consensus in a lot of the analysis that I've been reading, is that the mines near the railroads are going to be most successful in the future because they're the ones who are able to cut out the middleman with trucking.
We're talking right now with Pamela King, a reporter at Energy Wire, talking about how the drop in oil prices is affecting silica sand mining in Wisconsin. And Pamela, this has been a controversial enterprise here in Wisconsin, frac sand mining. What complaints have you heard from people who are concerned about the environmental and other ends of that?
Well, the concerns that I'm hearing there are, you know, the boom-bust cycle is a big concern, and some residents question why they should welcome such a volatile industry into their communities, especially when it has these long-term impacts. And there was one report out that really questioned some of the other reports that were touting benefits of frac sand mining. And this particular report from Thomas Power suggested that the costs of mining should be considered as well. And he also wanted people to consider what effect it will have on agriculture, farming, tourism, manufacturing. Especially with agriculture, there could potentially be competition for land, tourism. They're concerned that, you know, this makes it a less desirable area. There's concerns about property values. And, of course, there are a lot of concerns about health, particularly among the people who live very close to these mines.
Is there a sense among the people that you talk to that there are these concerns, while the revenue stream has been a fortunate thing for some of the towns involved in western Wisconsin, that it might also be good to develop other industries so as not to become too dependent on a single industry? It sounds like that's the case in some places, but are people looking to diversify?
Well, I think it already is a pretty diverse economy, and that's key to buffering against that bust cycle. Clearly, the people who are worried about their health, the economic benefits will probably never outweigh those concerns.
And what comparisons do you think can be drawn to other mining towns around the country as we wrap up?
Well, As the author of that paper that I had mentioned, Thomas Power's paper, he wrote, you know, mining has rarely laid the basis for sustained prosperity. And so that's the concern. Of course, Wisconsin has a long history in sand and gravel mining, but silica sand production has just taken up a lot more acreage. And, you know, people are also concerned about where the sand is going downstream. They're concerned that that this is a big contributor to the oil and gas industry, which it might not be an activity that they support.
And we leave it there, Pamela. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Pamela King, reporter at Energy Wire, talking about how the drop in oil prices is affecting silica sand mining in Wisconsin.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. As military service personnel return to life in the United States after serving in Iraq and Afghanistan, many are discovering that they have little in common with civilians. That's according to a recent series in the Los Angeles Times that tracks a growing divide between civilian and military life in America and finds that now more than ever, the two groups are living very separate realities.
We're joined now by LA Times reporter David Cloud, one of the reporters on that series. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, looking at the series, it looks like you're painting a picture of two Americas. One, civilian, people who don't really think much about what goes on in the military life, and the other, families and people whose lives center almost totally on the military. Can you spell out how that has worked out?
Well, you know, we wanted, after a decade of war or longer of war, we wanted to kind of take a look at the relationship between the military and society, and larger society. And we found sort of a paradox, if you will. On one hand, you know, the military has more support than it's had in decades, certainly since the Vietnam War. On the other hand, this tiny group of volunteers who make up our armed forces now endure sort of sacrifices, and their lives have been upended by the last decade of war in ways that most people can't even imagine.
Almost a separate warrior class is a phrase that comes up in your reporting.
Yeah, and some of them see themselves, some in the military see themselves that way. They're obviously highly competent, highly professional force that's been asked to do a lot of difficult things for the last decade. And if you talk to them, as I have and as my colleagues have, many of them express, you know, some feelings of alienation from society as a whole, coming home and feeling that people don't know what they went through, feeling like they don't know how to fit into a society that isn't really aware of the sacrifices they've made, and also just finding a place in that society that doesn't revolve around the military is difficult for many of them.
And this isn't just a feelings of separation. If you're in the military, especially long term, life is very much separated from civilian life. Can you talk about how people in the military really are living in different parts of the country, different places than the rest of us?
Yeah, that's true. You know, there are parts of the country that are heavily military, that have large bases, you know, that in one case, you know, a person we talked to characterizes, you know, sort of the country's largest gated communities. These are, because of concerns about terrorism, et cetera, highly defended places that you need special passes to get into. People inside those communities, you know, live, you know, lives that are almost separate from, you know, the lives of people on the outside. I don't want to overstate this too much because there are plenty of communities where the military is integrated. But, you know, for example, in a place like Fayetteville, North Carolina, there's a big base there, and the community is very dependent on the military. So there are pockets of military presence around the country now, but in large cities and in other parts of the country, there's, you know, running into the military is the exception rather than the rule. So there is a kind of physical separation that has gone on too. On the other hand, I want to make clear, you know, the military comes from our society. It's not as if there's some alien presence here or something. And there are National Guard units in communities all around the country that, you know, offer up their citizens and their citizens volunteer and then go back to their jobs. So it's not a black and white picture. It's more a sort of shade of gray here.
But for the active duty military people you talk to, in many cases, they are coming from a smaller pool of that society as a whole, often people with generations of military service behind them.
That's true. It's a sort of a self-selected group, particularly among officers. You find that sons and daughters of serving officers, serving active duty officers, they grow up on military bases. They accompany their parents, some of whom are two officer families, you know, on overseas deployments in some cases, you know, to places like Germany, certainly not to Iraq or Afghanistan, but they get into this lifestyle of the military, and naturally, as any kids do, they want to, in many cases, they follow their parents into that life. And, you know, so it becomes a sort of self-selecting kind of class.
Talking to David Cloud with the LA Times, talking about a series he worked on looking at a divide between civilians and the military in the United States. One of the most striking things that I saw in your reporting, David, talking to a World War II veteran, 90 years old, saying, back in my day, you never thanked somebody for your service because everybody served, just about, or most people served. It was really common. He sees things very different nowadays. It hasn't always been this way, has it?
Right. I mean, the big divide that we're talking about here is obviously doing away with the draft after Vietnam. I mean, that was a conscious decision by the military, you know, and by civilian leaders for that matter. They decided, you know, that we needed a sort of standing army, something the U.S. historically avoided having, a professional army to kind of play the role that the country needed the military to play. And after the kind of tumultuous period of Vietnam, nobody wanted to go through the kinds of protests and the kind of heavy drug use, for that matter, heavy alienation that many Vietnam veterans felt, both fighting in Vietnam in a war that many saw as a lost cause, and also coming home and being treated as, in some, or mistreated, if you will, when they came home. So there was a clear policy choice to do away with the draft, come up with an all-volunteer force. The result of that, though, and it's been very successful, it should be said. The result of that, though, is that you know, this group has been created that is separate from the larger society.
Another result seems to be an increasing reliance on National Guard units in active combat duty. And as part of this series, you followed a group from Michigan that had served in Iraq, Afghanistan, and then what their lives were like coming home. Can you tell us some about that?
Sure. I mean, the idea was that the Guard, at least in popular conception, is supposed to be this kind of force that straddles the civilian and military world. They're supposed to be able to go off to war, do their duty, come back and pick up their civilian lives. What I found, and I've been reporting on the military for a long time, but what I found was actually quite interesting, and that was that the length of time that people have been going off on deployments since 9/11 has really changed that myth in a considerable way. Young men in particular, you know, joined the Guard after high school and got on what they like to call a sort of deployment cycle, where they would go to Iraq, do a 9-month, year-long tour, what have you, come home, they'd have plenty of money in their pockets, they wouldn't get and didn't have a civilian job, so they would spend, you know, the next 9 months, you know, just decompressing, if you will, then they go on another deployment, and it just sort of goes from there. And now we're at the end of this long period, and many of them, you know, don't have careers. They're 26, 30 years old. Many of them have, some of them haven't been to college. So they're wondering sort of how do I sort of reacclimate myself to civilian life?
Yeah, so we end up with a situation where those people in the National Guard or the regular military have no experience with civilian life as they try to enter it, and they're meeting civilians who have no understanding, no direct connection to their experience in active service.
Right. And in the case of the story you were talking about, I focused on several members of this unit from Michigan who'd been in a pretty bad attack, all of whom had been injured in one way or another, four in particular, and sort of tried to focus on what it was like for them to come back, you know. And it's been frankly quite difficult for these four. Some have adapted and moved on. In most cases, you know, the older soldiers who have a wife or have a spouse, you know, and have a certain level of stability, maybe had a career beforehand, are able to readapt. It's not easy for them either. But for the younger soldiers or those who have been badly injured, it's a much, much more difficult process.
We're talking to David Cloud, reporter for the LA Times, about the gap between civilian and military life here in the United States.
And we want to hear from you. Do you think U.S. civilians are too insulated from the impact of wars? Have you served in the military? And do you feel the separation from civilian life? Do you think it's a problem? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We're talking to LA Times reporter David Cloud right now about his recent reporting on a growing divide between U.S. civilians and members of the military.
And we'd like to hear from you. Have you noticed this separation between regular society, civilian society, and the recent wars? How does this affect us as a nation? Have you served in the military? Have you noticed this separation? Civilians don't get what you've gone through. Maybe you have a hard time adjusting back into civilian life. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go right to our callers now. We've got Chris on the line in Madison. Chris, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. I just wanted to say that I have deployed from both active duty and from a reserve status, and it was much harder to deploy from a reserve status going from your civilian job to the workup and deployment and then your post-deployment era. However, my deployment from active duty was pre-9/11, and my deployments after 9/11 were much more appreciated by my employer and the civilians around me. So that made it much easier. However, I do also want to say that our culture and society does not prepare young people for adulthood as it did. Now, I've been in the service for 20 years, and when I first went in, a lot of my compatriots stepped into leadership roles within, you know, a year, year and a half of being in. And now it takes a year, year and a half to get 18, 20-year-olds prepared to even think about stepping up to a leadership role. So our culture needs to mature young people faster and not give them so many entitlements.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. He brought up a lot there, David. One point he made is that he felt the appreciation from the civilians around him, including his employers. In your reporting, David, you talked to some people in the military who thought a lot of the, you know, thanks for your service kind of statements were lip service, not sincere. What kind of things were you hearing?
I mean, you do hear that. It's not uncommon for people, you know, this divide is unlike the divide that existed in the country during Vietnam. It's not a hostile divide. It's kind of both sides, in some ways, like the way it is. There is plenty of support for the military, and some people in the military feel that it can be insincere, the sort of thank you for your service. Others like that and feel appreciated by that. I don't make a judgment about whether that standing up at ball games and applauding the troops and gestures that like that are, you know, some, as I say, some appreciate it, some don't. The question that I have is whether there's a deeper issue here in terms of whether we're creating one group of people who sacrifice and the rest and the larger mass of people who don't have to sacrifice, put their lives literally on the line. and whether that is an issue for the country, you know, going forward. Can a democracy really function that way long term? I think it's a real issue.
Chris, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Howard in St. Francis. Howard, hi.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I'm currently in the Army Reserve, and I'm a veteran of Iraq and Afghanistan. And I have no problem with doing deployments. I have no problem with serving. I have no problem with putting myself in harm's way because I do that freely and knowing the consequences. But what bothers me is that during the past 13 and a half years, numerous politicians have said, we're a country at war. We're not a country at war. We're a country at the mall. The United States Army is at war. The United States Marine Corps is at war. Not America. America has kind of abdicated their responsibility. And I say this because people think they're putting a yellow sticker on their SUV that's supporting the troops. What I want people to know or support the troops is, one, read about the issues. Two, vote, actually vote. And three, make yourself smart about what's going on around the world with American foreign policy, because most Americans are quite ignorant of the fact that it's not the Army or the military that goes overseas. It's the duly elected civilian officials that institute foreign policy, and the military then implements that policy. So those are my views, and I'm happy to take any comments you have off the air.
Howard, thanks a lot for the call. And that's a point that comes up in your reporting, David, the concern that with this large civilian population that isn't in the military, isn't sending their kids in the military, maybe doesn't know anybody who's deployed in many cases, doesn't have, as they say, skin in the game when it comes to American foreign policy decisions to send troops to other countries.
Yeah, that is one issue that really kind of is interesting to me, is that the declining number of politicians who've served in the military, and yet obviously they're responsible for sending troops into battle, and you know, in years past, most politicians, because of the draft and the ethic of service was stronger, had served in the military. And it raises an issue, which is, you know, to me anyway, I don't have an answer to it, but the issue in some ways to me is, you know, is it easier to go to war now because we have this professional military and let these sort of wars sort of proceed year after year with no resolution? And, you know, would that have happened in the old days when we had a draft and when almost everyone had skin in the game? There probably would have been more of a demand for a resolution than there is today. I don't know. I find that an interesting question.
And did anyone you talked to in the course of reporting, David, say we should go back to the good old days of having a draft, or were people happy with this volunteer military concept?
You know, very few people say that sort of thing. On either side, and to me, it's another example of how this is kind of a situation that neither side particularly objects to. The Pentagon certainly never wants to go back to a draft. They like an all volunteer force. It provides a motivated force. It's a ready force. They don't have to take people who don't want to be there and turn them into soldiers and airmen, et cetera. And certainly, there's very little support for it among civilians too. So I don't think that's ever going to happen.
Talking to David Cloud, reporter for the LA Times, about his reporting on a gap, a social divide, not necessarily an unfriendly one, between civilian America and the small percentage of people who serve actively in the military or have been deployed via the National Guard to places like Iraq and Afghanistan. Back to our callers at 800-642-1234 with Victor in West Allis. Victor, hi.
Well, hi. I'm a Vietnam era veteran. I'm 62 to 65 and served on the fleet. Here's one thing a lot of people don't realize. There's a lot of mental strain that when a personnel goes overseas and something happens domestically at home, that he or she cannot run right away and try to solve it. They have to do it far, far away. In my case, in the 60s, was all we had the snail mail, and a lot of people don't understand either. When my mom got sick, I was told, Vic, we can't ship you out because we don't exist on where you are. And that puts a lot of mental strain on you. So they said, well, notify through the Red Cross how your mother's doing. But till then, you're on your own.
Victor, thank you so much for sharing that. And David, you talk about this from both ends. Military families trying to keep tabs on what their deployed spouse is doing overseas and what condition they're in. And, you know, parents overseas trying to catch their kids' graduation on the internet. Talk about the stress on both sides there, please.
Yeah, there's a lot of stress. And you know, in a strange way, there's, as the caller alluded to, in the old days, there was just because of the technological situation, it was much harder to stay in touch other than through occasional letters. Whereas today, the Army and the Pentagon goes out of their way to make it possible for troops deployed to stay in much closer contact with their families. That is a double-edged sword, though. Families are much more aware of what's going on day to day. I mean, I think there's obviously some benefits to that. But it also, you know, it creates tensions, concerns, understandable concerns among spouses. And, you know, it's never going to feel exactly the same if you're in Iraq and your son is or daughter is graduating from high school and you're not there, even if you can, you know, see it, you know, on video or something like that. So there are always those kinds of tensions, as the caller said. But there's also a kind of, to me, this situation kind of reinforces the separation of the military. You know, most people aren't going through that, whereas these families are trying to adapt and figure out a way to stay in touch with these constant deployments that their spouses and parents have gone through.
When you talk about in your piece, you know, headlines that we might see in the newspaper the next day about an explosion affecting troops might more or less shut down some of these military communities as they're trying to figure out, who is it? Is it my husband? Is it my neighbor? Is it my wife? This affects this military side of the population much more directly.
It does. And you know, in this case of the Michigan unit that I focused on, you know, I mean, the wives of several of these soldiers who were injured were in touch with their injured husbands within hours of the incident. I'm sure that was comforting to some extent. On the other hand, it also, you know, intensified their worries. And in the old days, they wouldn't have known for days, and it would have taken, you know, the Pentagon would have had to notify them. In this case, they're aware within hours or minutes.
David, thanks so much for reporting, and thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was LA Times reporter David Cloud talking to us about the growing divide between U.S. civilians and people serving in the military.
The fast food industry is struggling these days. We know that. Giants of the industry are struggling to stay afloat. Places like McDonald's and KFC keep on trying to reinvent themselves. I say this all as context to prepare you, because Pizza Hut has just upped its ante and then some and announced its new Hot Dog Bites pizza.
Yeah, so this is, as I understand it, a pizza, right? That's easy. With little hot dogs, kind of a pigs in the blanket rolled up in the crust.
Right. So in concept, right, you take one thing people love, hot dogs.
Right.
You put it together with another thing people love, pizza. But together, there it is, a hot dog bites pizza.
Because you want the mustard on the hot dogs. Do I want the mustard on the hot dog pizza? I think I probably don't. And then it seems like, where do you go after hot dogs?
Right. Slippery slope.
It's a new frontier.
What's next?
Right. I don't know. Cheetos? Almonds?
Little Debbie pizza bites?
Ooh, I might try that. Gum? All right, maybe not gum, but I don't know. I think this may be taking it too far. Yeah, I think this is something I will never actually consume myself.
It's
I'll say that, my bottom
out,
line.
It's worth checking out, though. Just the visual of it is something to see. You should check it out on the Central Time Facebook page. Let us know what you think. Did Pizza Hut nail it, or did they go completely around the bend on this one?